Black Death is a grim term even without any historical details, but then attach the history and it only gets worse. The Black Death killed maybe 60% of Europe's population in the Middle Ages. But the topic of this hour is San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century. Bubonic plague, the source of the Black Death, showed up in that time and place, and interference from political and media figures contributed to cases of the plague showing up for several years beyond that. David Randall unfolds a story of disease and mismanagement and greed in the book Black Death at the Golden Gate. David K. Randall is a senior reporter at Reuters. He has a couple of other books to his credit, Dreamland and The King and Queen of Malibu. David Randall, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Did this work start with what I imagine a lot of people's response would be, Black Death in the United States?
Exactly. So I was actually working on my last book, which is a story about the family that used to own all of Malibu, California, and you know how they got it and how they lost it. And in that story, one of the main characters goes up to San Francisco around 1900, and he writes a letter back to his wife saying, "This is the wickedest place we've ever seen. And there's rumors that the plague is here." And I was really struck by the word rumors, because it seems like, you know, an outbreak of the plague is something that everybody would know about or not. There wouldn't be really a gray area there. And I started looking into it, and I found that city officials, the governor of California, and the editors of the state's most powerful newspapers had conspired to conceal the truth of the plague in California, putting millions of people's lives at risk. And this was something, you know, I grew up in California. I lived in Berkeley for a while. I lived in the Los Angeles area. And I had never heard of this whatsoever. So it almost seemed like I had stumbled onto some alternative history, but all of it was real.
Right. It's weird that it seems like it's still sort of a secret after all this time, although it was revealed back then, too. We'll get to that in a bit. Black plague is best known for decimating Europe's population in the 14th century, but it sounds like there have been quite a few outbreaks since that time, too.
Exactly. So everybody knows, you know, from middle school or high school of the Middle Ages plague. Most people don't know that the disease never really went away. It came back in the 1870s from China and spread outward from there. So it killed about 10 million people in China overall, killed another 5 million people in India. And this was the dawn of the steamship age. This was the first time that people and goods could move across the Pacific fast enough that the disease could spread with them. So it spread to Hawaii in 1899, and then it seemed like it was only a matter of time before it reached North America for the first time.
It's interesting when you think of it as the steamship age, because we talk about this as the airplane age, where you know, people can get pathogens and pass them across continents in a matter of hours instead of days.
Exactly, and that was one of the big fears once the disease did reach San Francisco. You know, the city and the state didn't want to acknowledge that it was there, but health officials who were trying to contain the disease knew that this was the first time in history that somebody could get on a train heading east, and within a week you could have the disease in, you know, Denver and Chicago and Cleveland and New York and every other stop along the way, and it would move so fast that there would be no way to contain it.
You know, the responses to the advances are rather shocking in the book. I mean, we had obviously improved transportation technology, improved medical science. I mean, we had identified the bacteria that caused plague a few years in advance of this outbreak. But then you describe situations like the response when health officials tried to curb a smallpox outbreak in Milwaukee in 1894. What happened there?
So this was a time where it really was a fight for the legitimacy of science and medicine. This was really the one generation where medicine transformed in most people's eyes from something where, you know, a doctor was considered skillful if he or she was very fast because there wasn't much pain medication available, to an era where, you know, you think of medicine as something performed by people in white lab coats with microscopes and x-ray machines and everything else. That took time for that trust to be built. So in Milwaukee and other places, when there were outbreaks, there was one perhaps gut reaction to see that public health was just a front for stealing things, whether it's stealing medicine money from the public treasury or whether it's allowing somebody who calls themselves a doctor into your house and they can literally steal your possessions.
Wow. So then when plague showed up in American territory, this is in Hawaii, there was a bit of a racist element attached to it, too, it sounds like.
Exactly. So throughout history, every time there's been a disease, there's an inclination to blame whatever community is suffering from the disease first. And in Hawaii, this was in Chinatown in Honolulu. It was the first known victim was a Chinese immigrant. And as soon as his body was found, there was a quick quarantine of all of Chinatown, Honolulu itself. And it almost seemed to confirm all of the racist and xenophobic stereotypes. So quickly, police officers and soldiers surrounded Chinatown. Health officials inadvertently started a fire that ended up burning it all to the ground. There's a panic in Chinatown because, Chinatown is burning and soldiers wouldn't allow people to get out. They finally relented and they opened up a path, one exit out of Chinatown to a army barracks, which became a makeshift prison for everybody who was living in Chinatown at the time. And all along the route, you saw, white Hawaiians who were standing there with baseball bats and knives and guns and everything else, trying to prevent anybody from Chinatown from escaping.
So they would have been happy if the people had just died in the fire in Chinatown.
Exactly. I think that's what many people would have preferred.
Wow. This is just one of many amazing sub-stories within the larger story of Black Death at the Golden Gate, which is a bubonic plague in San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century. A story well told by David K. Randall in his book, Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. We'll get into further medical and political complications when we return to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 25. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is the Reuters journalist David K. Randall. He's written a book called Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. And if you're scratching your head, so was he, as he's already related. He grew up in California and had heard very little, if anything, about the story of bubonic plague showing up in San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century, well covered up by both political and media figures, it turns out. We'll get into the details as we move along here, and you can join the conversation on the exchange as well. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's start meeting some of the key figures by name. Joseph Kinyoon, a very brilliant scientist working for the Marine Hospital Service of the United States. Tell us a bit about him.
So he was, as you said, one of the most brilliant scientists in the country. He perhaps knew more about plague than anybody else in the country as well, because he had studied with some of the doctors who had treated outbreaks in China and India. He was in San Francisco, not because of the plague, but almost in spite of it. He was one of those people who is incredibly brilliant, but had almost a talent at making people hate him. So when he was in Washington, D.C., somebody had written an article saying that Kinyoon was responsible for increasing the scientific rigor of the Marine Health Service, which was essentially the forerunner of the U.S. Public Health Service now. This drove the U.S. Surgeon General crazy.
Is David back?
Hello?
Oh, there he is. Okay, good. Wow, not sure
I
what happened there.
I thought about that.
It happens from time to time. So where were we? Joseph Kinyoon. We're talking about his great reputation as a scientist anyway, but his boss shipped him out to San Francisco, and he did not view it as a promotion.
No, he saw it as exile, and he's there in San Francisco trying to find a way to back. And he knows how powerful medicine can be, and he knows how dangerous plague can be. So as soon as the first known victim of plague is found in Chinatown in 1900, there's a brief quarantine, but the city and state instantly say this can't be happening and lift it within 24 hours. Kinyoon, though, knows how devastating it can be, and he starts racing against the clock to try to quarantine and contain the disease before it can kill millions of others.
So they didn't want to talk about it. He did want to talk about it, obviously. Don't know why they would resist quite like that, but they had financial reasons for it. So let's talk about San Francisco's growth through the gold rush and how it contributed to its, let's say, hygiene.
So this was still, San Francisco was still a very young city. You know, this is only 50 years after the gold rush. There are still people who were literal, you know, 49ers and gold miners still walking the streets of San Francisco. And San Francisco has grown so rapidly and with such a, you know, every person for themselves mindset that there's no concept of, you know, the public good and public hygiene whatsoever. This is a place where when you're walking on the street, you'll see the body of a dead horse, that people will just throw out trash from their windows and expect and be thankful that the rats are going to take it away. This is a place where, even as the city has grown to be the largest and most important city in the West, that its spending on public health has actually declined. So it's really still a frontier boomtown, even though it has the veneer of a respectable city now.
So, for example, Wong Chut King was a plague victim. What were the conditions of his dwelling?
So he lived in Chinatown itself, which was the most abhorrent part of San Francisco. The Chinese at the time faced outward bigotry, and this was the era of the Chinese Exclusion Act and other laws which made it difficult for Chinese immigrants to own property, to become citizens, and everything else. So they were essentially forced into a very small area, which was now Chinatown, and many had to share rooms. Wong Chut King lived in a subterranean basement room, which he shared with two other men. It was abhorrent. The smell was so bad that it would force someone to gag. An open sewer pipe was dripping into his room. Rats were a constant companion. And it just seemed a place that seemed to breed disease.
Gross. So what is the telltale sign of someone with bubonic plague, David?
So there are three forms of bubonic plague. The first form is the classic form bubonic, which is you develop what's called a bubo, which is a swollen lymph node that fills with blood, and it's either in your groin or your armpit. Once you have this, once the bubo develops on your body, you have about 48 to 72 hours before death, and that death will be gruesome. It'll be, you know, fever, delusions, vomiting, losing control of all your bodily functions, and you know, then eventually you die. The second form is if you don't die quickly from bubonic plague, it becomes septicemic plague, which is essentially gets into your bloodstream. And then the third form, which is the scariest form and the most virulent, is pneumatic plague, which essentially gets into your lungs, and then you can spread the bacterium just by coughing alone. And this is the form that decimated Europe in the 1300s.
So by the time a bubo shows in the bubonic version, is a patient beyond saving?
At that time, yes. This was still an era which was essentially the doorstep of the modern age. It was, you know, we were very close, but we weren't there yet. So there were no antibiotics. There was no known cure for plague at the time. There was no vaccine. We still have no vaccine for plague. Now, however, if you were identified with plague, and about 10 people each year in the U.S. are identified with plague, antibiotics can cure it. It's just the danger is it's a very fast-acting disease. So you really have a very short window of 2 to 3 days to get this medicine, or it'll be too late.
David K. Randall, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about bubonic plague in San Francisco at the turn of the 20th century is called Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. You can join us on the exchange. Questions, comments, stories to share, 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's get some more of the racist element of this in here. Did people of European ancestry, because this came in through Chinatown, think they were immune?
They did. If your ancestors were from Europe and they had survived the plague outbreaks in the 1300s, then somehow you would have evolved immunity, which was not true. And because of this, there the disease was really cast in a racial lens. You had someone even as high as the Surgeon General saying that people with European ancestry couldn't get plague because they ate a more quote-unquote muscular diet of meat, while people from Asia ate a diet of rice. So everything could go into seeing this as a disease of, you know, perhaps the other, somebody else that the majority of the community could not get. That was the way they treated the disease, and that was the way they viewed it. That was one reason why the initial quarantine was so short-lived. It was this idea that, you know, the whole city can't possibly be at risk. It's only a risk for people in Chinatown because of race.
So a short, the original quarantine was short, and then once no cases showed up, if the Chinese don't have it, we're not going to have it. So poof, that was it.
Exactly. So then the disease continues to spread. By within a year or two, over 200 people are dead of plague that Kinyun knows about. What happens is that Kinyun is so aggressive that Chinese immigrants who are in Chinatown on the front lines, they start hiding bodies from him. They don't want to admit that the disease is in their community either, because it seems to confirm all the stereotypes that they're so scared of and that they have to deal with every day. So it's a whole city that's in denial, and it's really a race against time before the entire country will have to pay the price for it.
Wow. So everybody's got a reason to hide the idea of bubonic plague being in San Francisco. Joseph Kinyun has the stuff. He's got tests that for sure show, because we already knew what the bacteria was. Yersinia pestis, we knew about this time. Who else pilloried him besides the Chinese and the government leaders?
It was even actually his colleagues who were in the Marine Health Service, who should have been his natural allies. But Kinyun, due to, you know, his rough personality, he thought he was better than them, and he kind of did. You know, he kind of made it known that he thought he was a better class of doctor, and he was. To be fair, he was. But at the same time, you know, even had the governor of California, Henry Gage, and perhaps a pioneering of what politicians say now with inconvenient facts. He essentially calls plague fake news. He starts giving nicknames to Kinyun and starts referring to him as suspicious Kinyun. And the newspapers follow this as well. The San Francisco Chronicle runs editorial cartoons showing Kinyun trying to pick the public treasury locks with keys that just say fake plague or fake quarantine. So he's really surrounded by on all sides by people who don't trust him and who hate him, essentially. And he continues persevering because he knows the danger, and he doesn't want lives that could be saved, people to die on his watch.
Well, gee, thanks, San Francisco Chronicle. It's an interesting twist here that this was long before the Chronicle was owned as it is now by the Hearst Corporation, but it was William Randolph Hearst himself who apparently turned the tide on the plague, at least in some respect.
Initially, yeah. So the local papers refused to print anything about the truth of the plague. Each headline, as it continues each week, continues to be plague fake grows, or plague fraud grows. It's only after Hearst's line of papers writes an article saying, essentially, you know, the Black Death is in the United States, that it forces the city into action. That's because, you know, so much of San Francisco's economy is built on people coming to California. It's still, you know, the Golden State, and it's really literally that people read the article. Maybe they're on a train in Denver, they read the article about plague being in San Francisco. They get off the train at the next stop, and they start heading back east. So the city is forced into addressing this. But even then, they only do cursory things. They say that they're going to fund a cleanup of Chinatown, but they almost take pains to find anything, avoiding finding anything that could be dangerous or unsanitary, which really takes talent at that time to not find anything that we would now consider disgusting.
Right. Once it was clear that there was an outbreak, and so they required some kind of action after the Hearst papers got onto this. How did Kim Yun want to handle the outbreak?
He continued to want to go have more and more stringent and draconian measures. After the failed campaign to inoculate Chinese immigrants by mandatory, he then tries to quarantine Chinatown again. When that doesn't work, he goes farther and farther. He eventually briefly quarantines the entire state of California. He says that nobody can leave the state and no goods can leave the state unless they have a signed form from him testifying to their health. This understandably drives everybody in California crazy. A state senator in Sacramento stands on the Senate floor and says that Kim Yun should be hanged for his actions.
Wow, that's getting serious. Were people openly suggesting things like in addition to hanging him, were they suggesting that Chinatown needed a Honolulu style cleansing?
Exactly. That was one of the biggest fears of the Chinese and Chinatown itself. Chinatown is located right in the heart of San Francisco, right in downtown. It's probably some of the best locations in the city. So there was the big fear that the Chinese in Chinatown would only have to look at Honolulu and say that could be us as well. So there was constant fear over what the next step could be.
There's an important cameo appearance here by a guy by the name of Dr. George Schrady. What was his part in all this?
So he was one of the most well-respected doctors at the time because he was essentially the health correspondent for the New York Journal, which was one of the largest papers in the country at the time. Think of him as, kind of a Dr. Sanjay Gupta or something, as somebody who is as well known as being a media health figure. He comes out to San Francisco to try to determine once or for all whether plague is truly there. And Kenyon shows him, samples from plague victims. He proves to him that plague is there. And Schrady writes an article saying, I hate to say this, but this is true. Instantly, the city turns on all of its mechanisms to prevent this to change his mind and prevent him from writing additional articles. Henry Gage, the governor, sits him down and says, essentially, how do you know this is true? Kenyon gave you these plague samples. How do you know that he wasn't faking it? Do you really want to have the entire economy of California and all these people's lives on your shoulders if you say this is true? And they're able to, within 2 or 3 days, get him to completely change his mind. And then by the time he leaves, he says that if there are not more known victims, living victims of the disease, then Kenyon should essentially be kicked out of town.
Wow. So yes, it's plague, and then no, it's not, in a matter of days from one scientist who should know better. That's one of many, many twists and turns in the story of Black Death at the Golden Gate and the race to save America from the bubonic plague. Back to talk more with David K. Randall and take your phone calls and emails on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're hearing about an episode in California history that a lot of people hadn't heard about, including the author of the book we're talking about today, Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. If you're scratching your head, you are not alone, because it was very well covered up at the time and insisted upon by political and media leaders that no, there was no bubonic plague in San Francisco. Let's cut to the chase. There was, and it finally had to be taken care of over the course of several years. It lasted a lot longer, perhaps, than it would have if people had admitted there was a problem in the first place. That is the story David K. Randall talks about in the book. He's our guest. You can join the conversation at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I want to go back and get to the result of another detail that we've mentioned already, which was that at one point, Joseph Kenyon from the Marine Hospital Service, the precursor for today's Public Health Service, said we need to close California off. Well, that went straight to the top. Need we ask what President McKinley's instructions were?
Well, essentially, this was... he said to rescind the order right away. He didn't want to lose California votes. But on top of this was really Kenyon's undoing. Not long after many of California's congressional delegation, along with business leaders like Levi Strauss and others, met in the White House, and they essentially brokered a deal that they would say that Kenyon would be sent elsewhere, and the city and state would fund a true, quote-unquote, cleanup of Chinatown. So that happens. Kenyon, even as he's leaving, continues to say, plague is here and you are all in danger, even though nobody wants to believe him. And pretty soon, California thinks it has its problem solved, even though plague truly is still there.
So the problem they solved was with having Joseph Kenyon in their midst, and they got rid of him. His reputation was in tatters. His boss had separate findings of plague being there and wouldn't release them. What finally blew the lid off the no, it's not the plague cover-up?
Well, what happened was they sent in another federal health officer by the name of Rupert Blue. And whereas Kenyon was really thought of as one of the most brilliant scientists in the country, Blue was not. He was known as someone who's kind of lazy, in fact. But what he had going for him was that he made people like him. He had a great sense of affability. And he starts doing things that are considered radical at the time, whereas Kenyon always stayed at his laboratory on Angel Island. Blue opens up an office in Chinatown itself. He hires a Chinese translator and treats him like a full member of his staff. And he slowly starts to make inroads against this disease in the and starts containing it, even though the city still does and the state still doesn't want to admit it's there. He goes so far as that he's actually able to almost stop the disease from spreading further. And he's so successful that the Surgeon General sends him somewhere else, essentially, you know, tell him to go put out the other next fire. It's only after the Great San Francisco earthquake of 1906 that plague finally spreads outside of Chinatown and spreads throughout the whole city. Now this is when you have 60 people die in the span of 2 or 3 weeks. And it's really the crisis that Kenyon was always trying to avoid.
Well, we have a phone call here from Val in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with David Randall, the author of Black Death at the Golden Gate. Hi, Val.
Oh, hi. I used to work for the State Health Department in California on bubonic plague, but we don't have to go to California. We have it right here in Oregon. I found it several times in rodent die-offs in the Sierras and in Klamath Falls. And I found it also near Yreka and weed. We'd find die-offs in rodents, and we'd send them into CDC.
So why did it not spread? I mean, what is it that stops it from getting from rats to people?
Well, it does get into... there's an interface between wild rodents and domestic rodents.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to get into the domestic rodent population to get near people. But we did have plenty of campers that would pitch their sleeping bag near a rodent, like a ground squirrel, where it died from plague. And then the fleas come out, burrow, and bite the person in the sleeping bag. And they can get, we always had 2 or 3 a year in California.
Uh-huh. And any in Oregon that you're aware of?
In Klamath Falls.
Mm-hmm. All right, so not many, but still out there, you're saying?
Oh, yeah. We'd get one every other year or so.
Okay.
Someone would be exposed to bubonic plague.
All right, thanks for that, Val. Appreciate the update, although I can't say it makes us feel any better. But knowing is really power. That's one of the points of the book, David Randall.
Exactly, and one thing that's so interesting is one of the reasons why plague is still in California and Oregon is because of this story. The doctors in San Francisco really were able to contain the disease through a mixture of luck and putting in radical health measures at the time. But they weren't able to prevent it from spreading to the wild rodent population, squirrels and rats and everything else. So it really is this legacy of their failure in some ways. We get to benefit from so many of their milestones and achievements. You know, and these are some American heroes that nobody's ever heard of, and we get to benefit from their genius. But there's downsides, too. And one of the themes of the book, too, is that you know, Kenyon represented in many ways like the hard side of science, the epidemiology of how do you treat a disease, how do you track it. But he failed in many ways because he didn't also focus on the softer side and the soft science of persuasion. How do you get somebody to take steps to protect themselves and not only protect themselves and protect others as well, because they trust in what you're doing and they see what you're doing as legitimate.
I think what you said was there's no vaccine for bubonic plague yet, but Kenyon did order a serum to be brought to Chinatown. What was in that serum?
So that was known as the Hafkeen serum. And what it did was it prevented your chance of getting plague by about 40%. And it wore off, too. So it's not a real vaccine. It's more of an inoculation. But it was one of those things where the side effects were so strong that it turned people off from ever wanting to take it. Your whole body would become flush for several days. You'd have a high fever. You'd vomit. You'd have aches and pain. So it almost seemed for many people to say, why would I subject myself to that if I don't believe plague is here in the first place, and B, even if there is plague, I won't get it because I'm not Asian, or C, I don't believe this medicine could really do anything for me anyway.
Wow. So what a mix of science and political science and racism and sociology and all that stuff that comes together in this story. We talked about Rupert Blue, who ended up running the health service in the San Francisco area for the federal government, and his powers of persuasion were far better than Joseph Kenyon's. So the politics aside, though, what kinds of health practices did Rupert Blue undertake to help defeat the plague?
So he was the first one to demonstrate and practice that it really was the fleas that were spreading plague. And he did this by pretty innovative ways. You kind of think of, what are the best things we like about San Francisco tech workers now? You know, willingness to fail, willingness to look at angles for problems from new angles. He did all those things, just in 1900 with focusing on rats instead. So he did everything from instituting street sweeping and rat-proofing trash cans and concrete sidewalks so that rats couldn't burrow underneath them, all these things which were radical at the time, to doing things that, we might not think of now. He gathered a bunch of healthy rats, and he dyed them different colors. You know, this one's fur was red, this one's was green, this one's blue, and he released them into the sewer system, and he put up flyers saying, if you see a colored rat, let us know where exactly it was. And he was doing this because he was trying to find, essentially make a subterranean map of the rodent passageways throughout the city so he could know where to lay traps, where to target his actions. And over the course of this rat-proofing campaign, and he really is the first one who gets people in San Francisco to join in and to work with him as opposed to working against him, they process and kill over 2 million rats, which is something like five times the size of the city's human population at the time.
That is one thing I noticed in looking for pictures for the website to help tell the story was that you look up bubonic plague at Wikimedia Commons, for example, and there are always lots of pictures of many rat carcasses being laid out and laid open in a lot of cases, too.
It's exactly. One thing one biologist told me was that plague is essentially a disease of rats that periodically gets into the human population. And this idea that you could spot disease within, the cells and organs of a body, and you could know what exactly the bacteria was that causing it, what it had caused it, was something that had only been discovered a few years before. So one thing that drew me to the book was, you have this era where medicine is rapidly changing, and during the middle of this transformation and revolution, it's called upon to defeat perhaps the scariest disease in human history.
I'm impressed that one of the things that Rupert Blue did was he essentially crowdsourced his operation a bit. When he's asking people to look out for the red rat and the blue rat, that's asking people to help with a project.
Exactly. It gets a sense of buy-in in many ways. And then he did other things as well. He would pay people to bring in rats, whether dead or alive, give them in a nickel or a quarter. So you essentially turn teams of kids in San Francisco into amateur rat killing squads, who would come in, bring in a bunch of rats to for money, But he would also do everything else on top of that as well. He would talk to every civic group that would have him. You know, he would talk to longshoremen. He would talk to, you know, society teas, everything else, to spread what was essentially the gospel of rat eradication. He saw this as a way to save the city. And this was radical in so many ways because, you know, Kenyon, before him, was a brilliant scientist, but for all of his brilliance, he could never really see past race. Blue could. He could see that this was a problem of sanitation and fleas as opposed to a problem, a social problem of race or anything else.
But you didn't have it because you were Chinese, but because you lived in Chinatown.
Exactly. That's where the disease was. And there was something that was preventing plague from spreading quickly in San Francisco. And that was the thing that was the big mystery for both Kenyon and Blue. They knew from studying outbreaks and other places that plague had this strange habit of spreading slowly and then exploding throughout the population all at once it reached some tipping point. And Blue knew that they were getting closer and closer to the tipping point. He just didn't know when exactly it was. So he really, that's what was driving him so much to try to get the public to work with him, because he knew that it could be the next day that the disease exploded out of Chinatown. And it was really after the 1906 earthquake, where, you know, rats are moving throughout the city to find rubble and everything else. That's when you start to see that explosion happening, where suddenly you have plague throughout the, you know, San Francisco itself is a very geographically varied city. You have beaches, you have a forest, you have downtown, you have horse stables. You pretty much have every landscape that a public health officer would have to deal with. And he knew you'd have to have something that could work in each one of them.
So for years this went on. All the time, of course, the San Francisco media, which were newspapers at the time, contributed to the situation getting worse by doing things like deriding bacteriology. We can pride ourselves, David, on knowing more now, both scientifically and sociologically, but are there notes of caution for our time with San Francisco's experience with the plague?
Well, definitely. So it's one of those things where, you know, times change, but people don't change. There was another outbreak of plague in 1924 in Los Angeles, and Blue once again had to save the city and the country from it. And this time it was in a Mexican-American community, and you saw many of the same things. It was considered a racial disease right away. It was considered a disease that, you know, the city at large could not be, was not in danger of. But it's one of those things, too, that if you, you know, I think one of the big lessons from the book is that it really took the soft science of from Blue to really save the day, even though Kenyon had all the scientific knowledge at his background. And I think you can make a pretty clear, you can draw a pretty clear line to things like the measles outbreak today. You know, we know the science is there, but the disease is now spreading again after it had been eradicated in the country because perhaps we're failing on the softer side of convincing people that this is true and that this is something that can harm them and that they need to take steps to protect themselves and others.
Yeah, a lot to think about from this for our time. The book is called Black Death at the Golden Gate, The Race to Save America from the Bubonic Plague. It's the work of David K. Randall, a senior reporter at Reuters. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
All right, take care.